I'm returning to these letters in Revelation 2 and 3. I've previously endeavored to draw our attention to the Lord who speaks with his church, who he is, how he is described, and what we might know of him as he addresses these churches and as he addresses his church ever since. And tonight, the particular aspect of these letters that I wish to focus on is it really arises from the way that the Lord opens his, he does address and gives his own introduction in each of them, and then generally speaking, the way that he begins addressing the churches. In most of these, he says, "I know your works." But in particular, the aspect of these letters where it speaks of the Lord's knowledge and his care of his church in the sense of encouragement, that he knows and cares, therefore be strong. Just to remind you, taking for example the first of the two letters we read this evening, when he wrote to Smyrna, there he said to them, "I know your works, tribulation and poverty." A little further, "And I know the blasphemy of those who say," and so on. In verse 10, "Do not fear any of those things you are about to suffer." And at the end of that verse, "Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life." This is something, a taste of the things that the Lord was saying to his people at this time. Remember back in chapter 1, verse 17, John says, "When I saw him," he's described who this is, the very same Lord who writes to his church, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead." These terms that he has used to describe this one he saw, they describe someone awesome, someone who takes away any self-confidence a man may have. That's what happens when he fell at his feet as dead. There is no other response suitable but to humble and prostrate oneself before him. Here is the one who describes himself as the living one who conquered death. He's the one who is reigning. He is the mighty, the true. He's the one who hates falsehood. He's the all-seeing with those blazing eyes. He's the one who conquers all who are false, the one who is completely faithful, and the very source of life itself. These are all descriptions of the Lord who writes and speaks to his church. They're the descriptions of the one true and living God, who, in the terms of Revelation, walks in the midst of his church. It is this Lord who knows his church. And it's this Lord who cares for his church. It's the Lord who knows. He knows our works, our tests, our condition. It's the Lord who cares, and he cares for truth. He cares by providing, and he cares by encouraging. Perhaps I say at the outset, this is not all the evidence of his knowledge and care. There is more on another occasion, more to follow. But this is the particular aspect that I would highlight today. The Lord knows, and in most of cases, he writes to the church and he says, "I know your works." The Lord knows our works, the things we do. Where does that leave us? I mentioned John falling at his feet as dead. Very similar response was in the experience of Isaiah the prophet. He was the prophet of God's truth, the words of truth on his lips. And he tells us in the 6th chapter of his prophecy that he saw the Lord and he was struck down, as it were, every part of him acutely aware that his very words were sinful and unclean. That's another example that before such a one there is no hiding. We may have a name for honorable things, whether it is true or not. He knows that truth. He knows what is within. His eyes see. And that's what he means when he says to each of the churches, I know your works. He knows our works. And if he knows our works, what will he say? When God says, I know your works, what will you do? We see something like this at times. I remember talking with the children one Sunday morning, that when someone, whether it's mum or dad or the teacher, says, so-and-so, come here. And all sorts of emotions go through the child's mind. Does mum know something about what I've done? Does the teacher know something? If they were to say, I know what you've done, what comes to mind? Well, this is the Lord who does know. He knows more surely even than we know ourselves with our deceitful hearts. Do we hold our breath when he says, I know your works? Perhaps we should. Surely we should. And not necessarily in excitement at the prospect. Because the works even of the church cover the full range, as we see in these seven letters. There are some who have labored and they've held true against opposition. For some, it was even opposition by the majority in the church. There were just a few in places like Sardis and Laodicea. There are those, like Laodicea perhaps, who have smoothed their way within the culture around them. There is the whole range of works within the church. And we fool ourselves if we think that there is anything hidden from his sight. And all the more so if we therefore fail to ensure that we are walking as he would desire. Now it's just to make that one point. He says quite simply, I know your works. We'll develop these things as we go along further. But he also says, I know your tribulation, your tests. That first line in chapter 2 and verse 9 really sums up a great deal of what he is talking about to all of the churches. He knows the things that put us to the test in our works. There are several cases amongst these churches where, as well as knowing what their works were, he spoke of knowing what they were facing as they tried to serve him or not, as the case may be. And as I say, Smyrna is one of the clearest examples of that. Along with knowing their works, he knows their tribulation. And this should strike a very comforting note for us, and something therefore that is well worth every believer taking seriously, that he does know these things. But just think of it in this light for one moment. You know, there are these wise sayings in various cultures, but who should know this better than we who are tested in this way ourselves? That as we respond to others, this is the way the Lord looks on others. He says, I know you're being tested. I know you're under tribulation. Well, how do we respond to others? We don't know either their works or their tests as he does. And for some it may be just like Smyrna, who are under that tribulation. It's a strong word. It's a hard word. It's a word that means a crushing burden. Just as the apostles wrote and as Jesus spoke, that's not an unusual or an unexpected thing. That must be expected, even as we read in Matthew chapter 5. It is a route of blessing, if you like, to be under difficulty, under a crushing burden, particularly from those outside. And it's almost like the Lord here, he says, I know you're under tribulation, but we need to move on. When it's a crushing burden, that might seem almost hard to bear, to add to that burden. But he doesn't spend more time on it. But he knows it. Just that in itself. He doesn't ignore it. He acknowledges it, recognizes it. But what it means, I think, is that it is real, but it's to be lived through, to go on living beyond it, as the various letters emphasize in their different ways, to be lived through in the strength of the Lord. There were other tests that the various churches encountered as well. There were tests in the face of what the Lord speaks of several times as the synagogue of Satan. The synagogue was really the gathering place, the gathering of Satan. And one of the more helpful ideas that I've benefited from somebody else is that Satan is the accuser of the brethren. And this is really just a great deal of what is going on here. That here were the Jews who were making life very difficult for them. The way the Lord himself speaks of them is, yes, there were Jews outwardly, there were Jews as far as their national connection was, but they're not truly Jews in their heart. They don't truly belong to God. Instead of that, they're this gathering of Satan, this synagogue of Satan. Is it that they are accusers? Surely that is a blasphemy in itself against Christ, which is the test that many of them were going through. There were those who would be tested by imprisonment. Smyrna again. Even the threat of that happening was a test too. As we know, there are many believers in the church throughout the world today who encounter that themselves. Amongst the tests, there were those such as in Pergamos, the next letter. The Lord knows the things around his people. I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. Most of these churches were living within a city that had one kind or other of the pagan gods. Some more, some it was just one or two, but in a major way. Others, there were a huge variety. And what better description where Satan's throne is? And perhaps in particular, the most vulnerable condition to be in was where there was emperor worship. It's known in church history that there was an actual severe division within the church because there were those who said it's okay to serve the emperor. But serving the emperor meant an oath of allegiance to him. And that oath of allegiance was that he was God, not just a man. That was what was required within such a context. Satan's throne, insisting that men would serve the emperor at that level as a god and worship him. I know where you dwell. I know the things around you, the ways in which you will be tested. All that pagan worship at that time and perhaps increasingly today as well. So the Lord knows our tests. The Lord knows also our condition. And it's not the same thing. You may be going through tribulation and you've got everything you need to combat it. These people didn't, at least not the Smyrnans and really not the others either. And that's why I read this particular letter and the one to Philadelphia, because they're two of the most acute cases. I know your works, your tribulation or tests, I know your poverty. And this is also a very, very strong word. one of the early Greek writers. He makes a difference between these two, between two words. There are two words for poverty. One means, well, you've got what you need, but you've got nothing left over, nothing superfluous. But this one means nothing whatsoever, nothing at all. How do you handle that? And quite possibly it was because of their Christianity that they had been thrown out, or whatever it was. How do you handle that? Well, perhaps the Lord himself gives an indication first up. I know your poverty, but you are rich. Consider your spiritual inheritance. Hold on to that through all of this. But you see, these things do have a bearing on one's capacity to endure and to live. It's almost as though the Lord recognizes that, humanly speaking, there is in this something of a reason why some people might falter and struggle in the faith. But for all that, he therefore almost seems to place more credit, not that they're earning salvation by credit, not that at all, but something of more credit is placed on their faithfulness. I know this, that you are so desperately poor. I know that you've gone through such affliction and testing. But I know your works, and that you are faithful. You have endured. Some have said that it's easy to be a Christian when life is quiet and comfortable. Well, a letter to Laodicea might call that into question. They had exactly that. And they were not terribly Christian as far as God was concerned there. But I think you know what they mean. It's not easy. It was a very demanding experience for these people. And the Lord says, I know that. I'm taking account of it, as it were. And again, we must be very careful ourselves to follow his lead, to be compassionate to others, to be sensitive to their condition, and at times things that we don't know, certainly don't know as he does. That's what he does with Philadelphia. Chapter 3, verse 8, he says, you have little strength. Isn't there just such a heart of grace and compassion and love reaching out to them there? And it's that the Lord, the things that he says to them, because of their little strength, it's as though he's coming alongside them to help them on their way. He knows our condition. And these are some then of examples from the letters of the things that the Lord knows about his people, because the Lord is looking for them. What a gracious God we have. King David once put it in prayer to the Lord. He says, this is not the way men do things. He was amazed at God's grace to him and the promise that he made. He says, this isn't the way men do things. Why are you doing it, Lord? It's utterly remarkable. And it reminds me that there were and there are problems within the church. There's more that we need to look at. That the Lord knows. He says he knows a great deal that is disturbing. And there are problems within the church, even today. But this to me reminds me that there are first of all people. I know your works. I know your tribulation. I know your poverty. There are first people. God's people. And every one of them a sinner. Every one of us a sinner. The Lord knows that better than we ever will ourselves. What does the Lord do? He says, I know all these things. And he goes on to say, I care about you. I want to encourage you, though I know these things, or because I know these things. Be strong, whatever these things are. And so that's my second main heading, the Lord cares. Before coming particularly to what he says to the people, well, he does say this to them as well, of course, but my first issue here is that the Lord cares for truth. And part of the encouragement that the Lord gives them is when he says that he knows And he acknowledges that some of them had resisted false teaching. That is a thing that features several times through these various letters. And of course, you can tell that I'm not going through them all in absolute detail, but just trying to mark out the main features of them. There is, for example, within very early on in the letter to Ephesus in chapter 2, verse 6, immediately the Lord in verse 2 has said, "I know your works," and so on. And there was that same kind of encouragement that we've spoken of. And then there was an interlude that he had concerns about them from verse 4. But it's almost that he returns to reaffirm them at verse 6. "This you have, that you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate." And these appear several times through these letters, along with several other apparently leading false teaching. We have no more biblical evidence for what these people taught other than what is in the book of Revelation. But most students at the time tend to think that it is not all that far. It couldn't have been all that far from a couple of the others that are mentioned, the doctrine of Balaam, for example, or of Jezebel. In chapter 2, Balaam is mentioned in verse 14, and then in verse 20 is this Jezebel who calls herself a prophetess. And I would hope we'll be better able to look at some of these, what they are actually are, to look at these next week. But they are false teaching, and false teaching which had effect in action, the deeds of the Nicolaitans. And the point here is that the Lord indicates his approval. He encourages the church's resistance to those doctrines. There's teaching going on here, which is false, and he says, well, I hate the deeds. That arises out of certain directions in teaching. He hates that teaching, that falsehood. What does appear in these letters, as I say, several times, that is one taste of it, is his great concern for truth. It ranks very highly as a matter that he's been looking for within his church. He praises them when he says that they tested the teachings of those who say they are apostles and are not, in verse 2 of chapter 2. He says, "You did not deny my faith. You held to the truth," in verse 13, writing to Pergamos. Here were people who had taken the stand against falsehood. They had taken the stand against this Jezebel's teaching. And the Lord assures them that he was satisfied with what they had adhered to. Down to verse 24, here writing to Thyatira, he has talked about the things that they have been dealing with, and then he says to them, there are those who have not this doctrine, but I will put on you no other burden. It is very shorthand. It most probably is a reference to the basics of the Christian faith. It reminds me of when the council in Jerusalem met and to deal with things in Antioch, and they sent a message back. "There's just a couple of things we would expect from you, but nothing else. We'll not put other burdens on you." Well, the Lord certainly will not put other burdens. This is the basic doctrine that has been taught. There is this truth, this faith that has been passed down. "I will put on you no other burden," not as those false teachers. There is God's care for the truth that is indicated here. There is also God's care, and here particularly for the people that he's writing to. His care is shown by his providing for them. Particularly in his promises. He promises to make the provisions that they have need of. This is also to be found in the promises to all who overcome at the end of each of the letters, and again, which I would hope to focus on another time. For example, the Lord does provide insight. Now you might say, well, this is, it's not bread and it's not clothing and so on. But this is what was needed. There is this insight. There are those who would find themselves in prison. This was the kind of trouble that they were going to be facing. What do you need in that kind of condition? Yes, there is this, an extent to which you would need that bread and clothing and so on. But first and foremost, to be there, they were going to need this insight into why they were there. And they would know, because of this word, that this was in God's purpose. The devil is about to throw some of you into prison, yes. But it's that, or in order that, you may be tested. You will have tribulation 10 days. That means a long time, but with a limit. You may be tested. But if you're faithful until death, through all of that, I will give you the crown of life. That was an insight. Remember when I was introducing the book, it was reminding us that when the Lord commissioned this prophecy, it was to write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after this. But it's to write them out as a revelation, to reveal them to men, so that we may see things in a way that we would not have seen them otherwise. It is this insight of the things that we deal with ourselves, day by day. Insight is a tremendous provision that he was providing for them, and that he will provide for his people. There are provisions for such as the weak brethren in Philadelphia. You don't have much strength, so I'm opening the door for you. It's an opening that no one can shut. I'm providing the way through, but you can come on into the kingdom. And there was a provision of protection from the trials to come on all men. And see how these things loom large. But it's not so much about even the daily bread, though he does provide for these things, but it is this provision for the sake of the gospel, and it's under its opposition. Protection from the trials to come on all men. Again, to this struggling church in Philadelphia. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. I will keep you. I will protect you. I'll provide that for you. That's what I mean by provision. But it strikes me too that there is also a provision offered to the Laodiceans. I pick this one up because it is, I think, distinctive. The Laodiceans, it's a letter which again will be more evident on another occasion, but the Laodiceans were a troubled church. They didn't think so, but they really were a church in trouble. A great distance from the Lord. One of the few cases where the Lord says, you're disgusting. For all their distance from the Lord, yet he comes towards the end of that letter and he says to them, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. That's a provision from a father to those he loves. He's willing to provide the correction that they needed. And more than that, he's willing to provide himself. He portrays a picture, and we've got all our theological niceties about it, but here's a picture where he is at the door knocking to enter in. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, what will I do? Will I provide some milk and bread and whatever and so on? No, I will come in and be with him. He's providing himself. He himself is at the door, ready for them, should any of them respond to him and his warnings. He will share. What a great provision. The Lord cares for his people, even those who have so little time for him. And perhaps through it all, it is pointing in this great direction, the Lord's care, because he knows the Lord's care by encouraging. And this is often the overall heading given to this part of each of the letters that the Lord goes to encourage his people. He does it by marking up the things that he knows, the things that he does care about. And then he says, well, essentially, in summary, he says, be strong. Of course, encouraging is just that. It is encouraging. It is providing courage. It is to make courageous. I spoke earlier of Joshua, that wonderful exhortation from the Lord, be of good courage. And I don't know if it was more to do with the enemies that he was facing or the people that he was leading. It was certainly what he needed, and it is just so for the church. With the various tests, some that we've touched on, the dangers that will be faced by those of the faith, we need courage if we're to be strong. For those who have so far endured, he is coming near and he's urging them to continue. At times he is promising not much more than even stiffer tests to their faith. But at the same time he gives a prospect of ultimate victory, that they will have blessing because they win through that crown of life. It is a word that was used of the laurel wreath, the victor, the crown that was placed on him. If they remain strong even through their weakness, they would receive the crown of life. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown, to Philadelphia, in verse 11 of chapter 3. And then there are others who have things to recover, to gather again. And what he does with them is to show them that he has pleasure in the things that they are doing that are good. But do more, he says. Return and build up the things that are good. Recover the things that have fallen away. And he's saying to us too, consider the pleasure of God. Won't you seek that he will be pleased with you? Wouldn't that encourage you to persevere in the life of faith? So there is encouragement in the things that the Lord says to his people. I'm just closing for the sake of this evening. And while I'm not examining every word or every expression or certainly not every cultural or historical setting for these churches, what I've been doing is to try and come to the intent of showing the mind of the Lord to his church here. And the Lord shows great understanding. Again, I summarize it with the words to Smyrna. I know your works, tribulation, and poverty. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Let us understand what his mind is towards the church. I've hinted at our own need to take care to have that same mind as we look on others, with far less knowledge and understanding. But I would add that this, I think, is enhanced all the more when we recognize that he has said such things to those churches. To them he's been kind, to them he's been gracious. Isn't he kind and gracious to us in spite of all that he knows of us? Because he does know us in just the same way. Of course, the picture needs more to be complete. But we come to this evening, I think. I would set it before you, because these words are intended for our comfort, fortifying us, strengthening us. It's for comfort throughout the church, with those first things that the Lord said then, because they are, by and large, the first things he said. He started with these things are good. I love you, and these things are good. His first words were to build up his people, because he knows. But it's also to encourage that we should be strong. We haven't arrived. There is more to go. There was for these churches. There is still for us today. And perhaps we're going to face tests in our faith. It wasn't my original plan thinking of these things quite some weeks ago. But it's interesting that the theme of this morning and of this evening point us in much the same direction. To be ready where our faith will be tested. But to be strong in the Lord for those tests and in that faith. And let it keep us even until death, that we too would seek out that crown of life and the smile of the Lord. May he bless his word to us this evening. Let us pray.